Hi, I'm Karen.
Hi, I'm Xintan. We are the hosts of the Unconventional Voices podcast.
Our podcast is about demystifying the current academic landscape, all while exploring innovative approaches to thrive academically and professionally.
Let's get it started.
Welcome to another episode of the Unconventional Voices podcast. This week, we have the pleasure of welcoming Dr. Thompson. Dr. Thompson is the owner of Michelle Dion Thompson Coaching and Consulting Services. She is an academic and legal coach. She helps women in law and academia who struggle with exhaustion and imposter syndrome build sustainable careers with their expertise, community, and soul. Dr. Thompson is with us today because she transitioned from academia to entrepreneurship. In this podcast, we like to talk about unconventional voices, unconventional experiences, and that's why we welcome Dr. Thompson today. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Thompson.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start with the first question. So why did you choose to do a PhD in history after having completed a law degree?
It wasn't on my bucket list. I will say that. I wasn't one of these people who were like, I'm going to be an historian in a day. I said never. I was at a point in my life, I liked practicing law. I was negotiating collective bargaining agreements on behalf of a local labor union. But I wanted to become a mom. Okay. And God bless the labor movement, and we need them, and they live hard and fast too, right? Like they work hard and they play really, really hard. So I was living more in a haze of cigarette smoke and, you know, drinking more than one might want to and living on caffeine and McDonald's. So there was that on the one hand. And then on the other hand, I wanted to have a child, and I'm like, how does this work? Right? Like I can't leave a child at daycare until 9 p.m. when I'm finished. Do I bring the kid to work with it? Like, I just could not figure out how the pieces were going to fit together. And at that time when I was starting to have these questions, I actually met the person who became my spouse. He was like, oh yeah, you could become an academic. I'm like, but why historian? Is because I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, my parents are Jamaican. On my mother's side, she's a descendant of a runaway slave community called Maroons. And that and the Haitian Revolution were the first two historical narratives I ever heard. Wasn't George Washington and all the stupid stuff they tell us. It was those two. And I was like, I'm going to check this out. I want to know more. And that's why I became an historian.
Oh, that's so interesting that you mentioned the Haitian Revolution, because, hey, that's my background. And it's so interesting also that you mentioned that those were your two entry point into history, which mine weren't, but that's awesome. I'm so excited that you said that. But because we're called the Unconventional Voices, the reason why we have you on this podcast is, one, to hear your experience as an academic, but also to hear why you left academia. So can you tell us the story of why you chose to leave academia to become an entrepreneur?
You know, it's interesting. The line isn't that clean. However, I graduated in 2012, right? 4 years after, I don't know if it was a global economic meltdown or a U.S. economic meltdown, because here in the United States, we think we are the world. So, you know, bear with me. it's just, you know, colonialism. Anyhow, and academia. So when I had gone into my program, the African diaspora was like the new field and, oh my gosh, and everyone will get a job and blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah. And then comes the 2008 economic collapse, and academia immediately, like, they started taking jobs off the market. And the fields that were open were, oh, surprise, not the African diaspora. No one was interested in the Caribbean anymore, right? We only become interested in things that are about the United States. Eye roll. So when I graduated in 2012, the market was really, really tight. I lived in Lower Manhattan. I was commuting an hour. So I live in New York City, New York, on the island of Manhattan, in the borough of Manhattan. And I was commuting 2 hours a day to teach either in Staten Island, one of the other boroughs of New York City, or New Jersey, at a public institution there. And, you know, because I was teaching part-time, I couldn't make the ends meet. Like, here were the bills, including the student loans, and here's my salary. More like it, and I couldn't make ends meet. I actually got really depressed. I actually was considering suicide, but at that point, I actually had a child, And I would look at him. He was thrilled to death. Like if he, when he visited my class, he would hear about the Haitian Revolution. He's like, Mom, I want to know all about this. I'm like, well, you got me. So I'm not going anywhere. And I've got all the stories. But I had him and I was like, that's a bad look. Like that's not going to work for him. And so I was like, you're going to have to find another way. I love journalism and I actually did a quick detour into doing journalism. Mm-hmm. And people were like, you'd be really great. You should get a master's. You can imagine my face when they said that. Okay, JD, MA, PhD. You want another degree? Nope. Done. It's been real. Mm-hmm. But journalism was undergoing the same contraction that we saw in academia as an industry. I'd been part of a peer counseling organization for, at that point, like 20 years. And I had seen, like, number one, they got me out of my hardcore slump, right? And I had seen the difference I had made in other people's lives. And I was like, you know, it'd be really great to do this, not as a volunteer. It would be nice to get paid for this particular skill that I had. So I opened, I went to my email. And it was all the same day that I had this thought. I went to my email. I looked and they said scholarship to become a coach. I'm like, ooh, I don't know that I know what a coach is, but that looks like what I was thinking about. So I applied for the scholarship. I won the scholarship and I hadn't looked back. So that was my off ramp to a really terrible job market in academia.
I also stumbled upon the story that you were, I think it was in 2019. That you posted on Facebook regarding one of your colleagues. I don't know if you want to share.
I'm supposed to say you did really good research. I'm like, oh, that one. Yeah, people saw that one. Yeah, I worked alongside Thea Hunter, who she's a brilliant historian. She wrote an article. There is a case. What is it called? Mansfield. It's the Mansfield case, if I'm correct. And it was the case that determined whether or not people who were enslaved in the Caribbean, once they got to England, would they continue to be slaves? And like most, a lot of historians don't deal with the legal component of things because they don't know how to read it. She actually had an article on that, right? And it was like, that, in addition to her other work, like that was the brilliance of what she did. I mean, I do it, but I'm a weirdo who has a JD and a PhD, but that's a different issue. So she had graduated from Columbia, brilliant, brilliant woman, had gotten a job at a public institution in Connecticut. And the people treated her so poorly that she left. Like nobody leaves tenure track positions. And that says everything about how people would bump into her and they're like, they treat her like they would say, are you the janitor? Parents would call about their children and how they were doing the class, just absurd, stupid conditions. So she was like, I'm out, I'm done. She left, but she never got another full-time job in academia again. And as a result, she had worked a series of adjunct jobs and she actually managed to publish while she was doing that at the same time. It turns out she had a health condition that wasn't letting up. There's a word for that and it's escaping me right now.
Chronic.
She had health, thank you. Such a basic word and I couldn't recall it. Yes. A chronic health condition. And she didn't have health insurance. So she got to the point where she actually, in the middle of the semester, she died. She died of the health condition. That's the challenge with being a contingent faculty member, right? That mm-hmm. you don't have health insurance, that you're not being paid well enough to actually be able to take care of yourself, right? She would go to the emergency room when things got really bad, but like she couldn't, if she had health insurance, she would be alive today, right? But that would require that she would have been a full-time tenured professor.
It's really unfortunate, but it's a reality that most of us encounter. I know that the majority of our listeners right now are currently doing their PhD, so this episode may not resonate with them quite yet, but this is why...
There's a preview of upcoming attractions. Sorry, maybe not. But let me qualify that. That actually, it's damning of academia as an industry, but it's also damning of the United States healthcare system. Mm-hmm. Right. If you're in Canada, this is not the story that you're going to tell. If you're in England, that's not the story you're going to tell, right? But that's the story that we tell in the United States, right? Mm-hmm. If you're adjunct in Canada, you actually have a public healthcare system that will hold you, so you would actually get regular care for whatever healthcare conditions that you have, or a hell of a lot more regular than what we have in the United States.
Yeah, and maybe some future Canadian scholars might move to the United States, and it's not something that they're considering. So hopefully that when they listen back to this episode, some of the information will
stick. Make sure
you
have private health insurance in this joint. Oh, yeah.
Thank you. But like I was saying, like, it might not resonate with them yet, because this is why we have Jinten and myself. Like, he's currently doing his PhD. Yes. I'm done. And for me, what's of interest to me is, like, what are other academics doing with their PhDs outside of the academia? So this is why we're having you. And hopefully, like, when listeners complete their PhDs and listen back to these episodes, they'll say, oh, okay, you've carried me through during my PhD, and you're also carrying me through post-PhD. The next question I have for you is regarding your entrepreneurship. If you had to do it all over again, what would you do differently?
I would have, woulda, coulda, shoulda, right? Being an entrepreneur was also not on my bucket list. Mm-hmm. It's like I was never going to do that, right? I was going to work for other people. However, if I had known that that's what I was going to do, I probably would have started working with people while I was a graduate student. Mm-hmm.
Are you saying start entrepreneurship sooner?
That's real, right? That's mm-hmm. real. There are a couple ways. I think when you're working on a doctorate, like you're, God bless your committee and they do what they do, but mm-hmm. because they're in academia, they don't see that there are other ways, right? They're like, but you get the job.
God, yes.
Right? Like, but you get the job and you teach and you publish and you do the things and you got tenure. Great. And I don't know if you noticed that the number of positions are contracting.
Yes.
So while you're busy going, I had an idea that I never acted on that would have been really amazing, right? Like, one thing that I could have acted on as a graduate student is, when I was a graduate student, Obama was elected as president. And, there's a whole lot of historical context for that, right? And to actually be someone, I could have merged my loves of journalism and history, right? And actually worked to sell stories about that, like about the deep historical context behind an Obama presidency, right? In a deep historical context about the Republican Party sending up Sarah Palin of all idiots, and I'm sorry, John McCain, right? Not that you're going to know where I stand on any of these things at all, right? Like, that's one thing I could have done. If I was thinking about, if I had thought, oh, coaching is a possibility at the time, I probably would have turned to my classmates as guinea pigs, like, okay, look, I'm going to give you this for little or nothing because it's not going to be like this after we graduate. So, like, work with me, right? And I probably would have, I could have definitely created a foundation for myself mm-hmm. there in a very, very different way.
Mm-hmm. I really like that you're telling the listeners to start thinking about what they want to do before they complete their graduate studies, because I what you just said resonated so much with me. I was near the end of my PhD, I was actually asking my supervisor, like, what should I do? And he always said the same thing, like, oh, try for academic tenureship positions. And you'll need to travel outside of that. And then I started questioning, is this really what I want to do? So thank you for sharing your story.
Yeah. Actually, and now that I think about it, like, I mean, even the journalism, like, I know a lot of my classmates would have been interested in coming together and writing stuff too, right? Like, that one, it wasn't something I actually had to do alone, right? And we all had perspectives on this stuff, especially because we were studying the African diaspora, right? Like, we had a lot to say, mm-hmm. right?
I could imagine.
And we could pull people in and actually give them different ways of looking at things and different ways of being a scholar.
Mm-hmm. And you had the medium too at the time, and you had access to all the scholars, so that would have been mm-hmm. ideal for a podcast idea.
Yeah. Right. See, like, I would never have thought of doing it. Like, but a podcast would have been an interesting way to launch something about deep context into new stories, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That would have been a brilliant way to do that.
I don't think academia prepares you for a career.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think that's its purpose.
But I feel like if I can chime in, I feel like coming from an East Asian kind of background, I feel like being a professor or being a teacher, people are really looking for the, you know, being stable for that kind of job.
Yes.
But I mean, it's not stable anymore. Like,
you're right.
Sometimes you can be a part-time professor for, I don't know, 20 years and you don't have all the health benefit and everything. I mean, even in Canada, it's the same. Although we have this health care system, you can get covered, but you also need good health package from your company, from your university to actually cover some, if you need to purchase medication, things like that.
Right.
I mean, yeah.
And that's while you're working? You're not even talking about pension yet. Yeah. So.
Right. Well, forget pension, but we don't do that here in this.
Yeah.
We don't do that anymore. Pension. Oh, I don't know. 1980. I think that's very, very true that the stability that is portrayed in the tenure track system isn't there. And I know in the United States, there are many, I don't know if many is overstating it, but there are a numerous chunk of public schools that are eliminating the tenure system altogether, right? Like, they're like, yeah, we're done with this. Mm-hmm. Like, if we like what you do, we'll give you tenure. I know that. I forgot his name, but the governor of the state of Wisconsin, did he eliminate tenure? Or came damn close to it, right? Like that's real. And, you know, Wisconsin is a well-known, well-respected academic institution, right? So the ways, I keep reading articles about eliminating the humanities. What could possibly go wrong there? I don't know, right? But like, you know, science without humanities, wow. That's, as an historian, that's frightening to me, right?
Mm-hmm.
I say all of that because the stability that we think is there in academia isn't there at all.
Mm, exactly.
And you cannot take it for granted.
And the stability isn't there, but students currently doing their PhDs or graduate studies are not thinking about what they'll need in the future in terms of health, pension, et cetera. And you only start thinking about it when you leave academia and you start your family. And it's kind of too late at that point because you didn't have time to prepare yourself.
I feel like when you're doing it, you're kind of, is this the word, short-sighted?
Yeah.
A little bit?
Yeah, because that's
you're
exactly
focusing
the word.
On finishing and you're focusing on, I'm going to get that tenure track position. But it's not very achievable.
No, it's not the reality.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
People do it. It takes years. I had a client of mine. It's been 3 or 4 years. And she finally got a tenure track position she wanted to be in a community college, but this was a community college.
Mm.
If she went to a regular, to a 4-year institution, she'd probably still be working on trying to get a tenure track position.
Crazy.
Yeah. Sorry, this is Grisha, my bad.
Nope, you're making us think and you're making, valid
those
points.
Voices.
Yes, we do need those voices. Talking about the need for those voices, as I mentioned in the introduction, you're an academic and legal coach, and you help women in law and academia who struggle with exhaustion and imposter syndrome build sustainable careers. So can you tell us a little bit more about #resistantvision?
Yes. The thing I love. So Resistant Vision came to me, literally, came to me out of my doctoral studies. And so, like I said, my academic work, it focuses on the descendants of a runaway slave community called Maroons. And I write about them in 19th century Jamaica. I still publish, et cetera. That's not gone, which is another moral you can take. Like, you may not be in a strictly academic job, but you can still do this work. And what Jamaica tried to do after slavery ended, which is 1832 in Jamaica, or in the British Caribbean overall, was to eliminate these communities. They didn't need them anymore, and why they didn't is a whole other thing. But one of the things that between 1832 and 1901, what was really interesting to me is that these communities made the gains that they wanted to make in spite of all of Jamaica's shenanigans. And I was trying to think, like, if I could very concisely sum up why that was the case, the two words that came to me were resistant vision, right? That these Maroon communities had a very clear vision of what they wanted to accomplish, and all of their resistance served that vision. They didn't resist just to resist. They were just pissed off on a given, right? Like, I mean, they were pissed off, but like, everything served the larger purpose of winning their, in this case, winning their battles for land. And that's like, that's kind of like, and I love the, I love like that what I work with clients to do is to build a vision outside of like, yes, there's a professional vision, but what is the vision for yourself, for your community, for this world outside of your, I don't know, 7 till 10 PM, the way that all of us work, right? It's hardly 9 to 5, right? What is your vision for that? And then how do you build steps towards that? And a big part of what I encourage, like there are three components to how I work with clients, right? There's calm, there's clarify, and then there's commit. And with the calm part of it, it's like the first thing we do, right? We use somatic techniques like emotional freedom technique, also known as tapping. We make sure that people have self-care and inventories. We also make sure that people have pleasure inventories, because I really don't think that the culture of overwork and burnout and all of the things that people in these two industries are going through is going to be solved by working harder on something else. I'm not here to call people into working really, really, really hard to create systems that are equitable. No, we're tired. We're sick of working hard. And that actually isn't, that's not going to work, right? That what I'm calling people into is like, we're going to have to rework these challenges in very different ways, right? We're going to have to be deeply in touch with pleasure, right? I love, like, there's a book that just came out called The Nap Ministry. Yes. Right? Rest as resistance, right? Like, we are going to create what we want by really just claiming the things that we need as human beings, that we need rest, we need good food, we need to move our bodies, we need pleasure, and pleasure can take so many different forms, right? I mean, there's good old-fashioned sex and good old-fashioned food. I'm here for both of those, right? But am I in a state of deep pleasure when I'm reading a book? Yes. Right? Am I in a deep state of pleasure when I'm walking in Central Park? Oh yeah. Right? Like there's like when we're playing with our dogs, right? Like that. But we actually get really disconnected from the multitude of ways that we can actually pleasure for ourselves, and that we let these industries steal that from us is criminal, right? And so that's what Resistant Vision is about, that we are going to create the vision that we want, a much bigger vision for ourselves, for communities, for our world, but not, we're not going to do this like by killing ourselves and working hard. We're going to do this by actually just showing up and being human. We're going to rest. We're just going to do the basic things that it takes to be human and actually have a good time while we're at it, right? If you're not dancing at your revolution, I don't want to be there.
Wow. Thank you so much.
I forgot who said that.
Thank you so much for sharing all those perspectives regarding a resistant vision, and which made me more intrigued regarding what kind of service or services do you offer to academics?
There are a couple things, right? Mm-hmm. I have a writing program called Time to Write. It's a 12-month program where scholars come together to write and to publish. And in that context, I work with you to actually break down what you need to do and to provide the support that you need to do it. We have writing challenges, we do online writing retreats, workshops, all of that to actually keep moving people along so that you're moving along, but without, you know, without sweat, tears, and pain, and oh my God, I hate you, right? One of my clients, she actually has taken wonderful vacations to France and stuff like that, and meanwhile is getting her book accepted by a prominent press, right? Wow. For publication, for tenure, right? Like that's possible. That's possible. This is doable, right? Yep. So that's one. I do one-on-one coaching with people, and that bleeds also into developmental coaching. If you have a series, with my editing, I'm developmental editing, not developmental coaching. But when I'm doing editing now, I want to work with scholars on their whole academic portfolio, right? Like, what are all the articles and what's the book you want to do? I don't want to just do one-off things anymore. That's not interesting to me. I want bigger visions to come into play, and I want to be part of that. So that's, those are ways that I support academics.
Wow. Thank you very much. And do you have any advice for our listeners from like a general perspective? Because most of our listeners are PhD candidates, PhD students, or some of them are PhD graduates. So what kind of advice do you have for them?
The way that you go about getting your PhD or finishing your PhD or starting your early career is the way that you're always going to do it. So it's time to inventory the ways in which I see the look on your face. That's when you're like, whoa, busted. Right? But this is the time that you actually want to inventory how you're going about what you're going about, right? Mm-hmm. Are you cutting corners on rest? Are you surviving on popcorn? I'm a big fan of popcorn, but like popcorn alone is not nourishment. Right. Are you sitting in your chair for hours and hours and you never actually just do something as simple as stretch or actually take a walk or something like that, right? The habits you have now are the habits you're going to rely on to go in the future. And this is the time to actually think through what and how you want to do this.
Well, I absolutely love that. Thank you very much.
Before you go to the last question.
No, I'm not going to.
Okay. I just wanted to say I found the quote. It was from Emma Goldman, 1869 to 1940. If I can't dance, I don't want to be in your revolution.
That's right.
So, I mean, besides asking how can our listeners get a hold of you, I also want to check in with you. Like, is there anything else you would like to add before we end this podcast session?
Nothing that I can think of. But you can always contact me at michelle@resistantvision.com.
Okay.
There's that. I'm still on the Twitters. I'm not going anywhere soon, although I'm looking at an alternative mask. Just screwed up everything. If you're going to find me on Twitter, my handle is mdeonthompson. Those are two very reliable ways to find me.
We also have your website,
resistantvision.com.
Yeah. So we'll include those handles, email address, and the website in our show notes so that our listeners can get a hold of you.
Excellent.
So
thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. There's my holiday cheer. Woo!
So if this episode resonated with you, if you liked the discussion, the topic, please leave us a review on Apple Podcast. Also, please know that you can reach us on Instagram at The Unconventional Voices, on Facebook at The Unconventional Voices. You can email us any topic suggestions at info@theunconventionalvoices.com. And thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you very much.